Pakistan Parliament's Deputy Speaker blocks a no-confidence motion against Prime Minister Imran Khan following days of political wrangling. A two-month truce now in effect in Yemen, the Ansarullah movement says, is committed to the ceasefire as long as the other party adheres to it. An Ukraine's top negotiator says that Russia has verbally agreed to key Ukrainian proposals for ending the conflict. Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behruz Najafi. Good to have you with us. Now, beginning this news hour with Pakistan, where a political saga has embroiled the prime minister for some time. A short while ago, the parliament rejected a no-confidence motion tabled by the opposition to oust the prime minister. The deputy parliament speaker has blocked the motion, calling it unconstitutional and blaming foreign interference. Parliamentary debate came amid heavy police and paramilitary presence on the streets of the capital, Islamabad. The no-confidence motion had been tabled by United Opposition, who blamed Khan for failing to revive the economy and crack down on corruption. However, Imran Khan says the efforts to topple him have been orchestrated by the United States. Washington, though, denies it has had any role in this. From Karachi, I'm now joined by Sayed Tomas Shah. He's a lawyer and geopolitical analyst. Good to have you with us, sir. So what happened in the parliament? Because the opposition, even Mr. Khan's own party, turned away from him, and the opposition had more than enough votes to put in motion this no-confidence thing, but Imran Khan survived it.
Yes, thank you for having me. It's a constitutional epic moment here in Pakistan right now. Just a few minutes ago, the Speaker of the National Assembly, even though the opposition claimed that they had 175, which is more than majority of the combined National Assembly here, to pass this no-confidence motion vote, they were actually prevented from doing so. The reason was because the government of Imran Khan moved a motion with the Speaker of the House to in respect to a letter and possible foreign interference in the political situation that's there. We know that Imran Khan spoke about this this letter, this mysterious letter. He kind of let it out that its origins were from the United States, from a third undersecretary, from certain sources citing Donald Liu. And it was basically an indication to certain to the ambassador for Pakistan, who's based in the United States, that with the current situation, essentially, if Imran Khan is removed, the things and situation with U.S. Pakistani relations would somehow improve. There was an indication for that. So there's a lot of opinions about this letter. Many countries express their opinions, their dislikes and likes. How far this was, of course, we weren't in that meeting. All we have is this letter I think, according to some sources, is really just a summary of that situation. I mean, we know recently Joe Biden has been openly calling for the removal of Putin, so it's not like anything that's surprising. We know within our history there's a lot of examples of this. So, but the current situation, just breaking news, is not only in the National Assembly has the vote been not put off. The motion was submitted, but the Speaker of the National Assembly has decided not to carry it forward. But the Provincial Assembly as well in Punjab also faced a similar situation where they have delayed the vote till April 6th. And allegedly the government has been able to gather a lot of parties dissatisfied members together, and they will apparently be together in the vote there. So let's see how that plays out too, but that's on a provincial level. Obviously, a lot of news coverage is on the national level as well, but I wanted to share that because it is the biggest province in Pakistan, and it is quite significant when we talk about the politics.
Okay, appreciate your comments. Sayed Tomas Shah, lawyer and geopolitical analyst in Karachi. Moving on, Yemen says it will commit to a UN-brokered ceasefire with a Saudi-led coalition as long as the other side adheres to it. Army spokesman made the announcement in a tweet. According to United Nations Special Envoy for Yemen, the two-month truce began at 1600 GMT. All offensive military operations, including ground, aerial, and naval attacks by the two sides, will be halted under the ceasefire deal.
As Yemenis are marking the holy month of Ramadan, a new truce was announced by the United Nations Special Envoy for Yemen to help the humanitarian situation in the country. The parties agreed to a nationwide ceasefire for 2 months, in addition to suspending all sorts of aerial attacks from both parties.
The international community has become convinced that this unjustified and barbaric aggression against the Yemeni people must be stopped, and the violations and crimes left by the war are a disgrace to the international community. There are indications of the continuation of the truce, and we hope that it will be the beginning of a complete end to the war and the lifting of the siege on Yemen so that we can confront the humanitarian crisis.
The agreement includes opening Sana'a Airport for 2 flights a week from and to Egypt and Jordan only, and allowing Yemen's fuel ships to arrive at Hudaydah Port. However, observers say this agreement is the result of the recent attacks of Yemen's armed forces against Aramco facilities across Saudi Arabia.
I think, of course, those latest attack against Saudi Arabia and as well in the last few months against United Arab Emirates, it has forced Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates to accept this truce. But it will be really clear in the coming days and week, will they accept this and will they, because there have been many like agreement that has been signed as an example in Stockholm. But still at that time, because Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates were not part of this agreement, they have not signed and they were not mentioned in any of those agreements. That's why they have actually not respecting them.
In addition to the war, Saudi Arabia has been tightening the all-out blockade it imposes on Yemen and has prevented Yemen's fuel ships to enter the country. This has worsened the situation in war-torn Yemen, which is already going through the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the UN.
Despite the tragic humanitarian situation of their country, Yemenis say there has always been light despite all the darkness. They believe the UN brokered agreement may lead to a comprehensive political solution as the Saudi war must come to an end. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Tensions running high in the occupied West Bank amid Israeli violent raids and deadly shootings in Palestinian villages and towns. Palestinians, mostly youth, hit the streets chanting anti-Israeli slogans. Ten Palestinians have been killed and dozens more arrested in the crackdowns that began earlier this week. The Palestinian Authority has strongly condemned the killings and stressed the call to the international community to provide protection for the Palestinians. Resistance groups, the Islamic Jihad and Hamas, also issued strong warnings to Tel Aviv after the forces opened fire on a vehicle, leaving 3 Palestinians dead in the early hours of Saturday. Hamas described the killings as a cowardly assassination and said the regime cannot guarantee its security by killing Palestinians. Islamic Jihad also identified the victims as its members and said that such atrocious acts will not go unpunished. In the Gaza Strip, people are observing another month of Ramadan under tough conditions due to the inhumane Israeli siege there. Our correspondent Ashraf Shannon has the details in this next report from Gaza.
Some 2 million Gazans are observing another holy month of Ramadan under the Israeli blockade for the 16th time in a row. Muslims around the world enjoyed this holy month while people in Gaza struggled to observe it under inhumane conditions. People in the tiny coastal enclave have limited access to food and they are also denied the right to freedom of movement. During this holy month of Ramadan, most Gazans are impoverished as their incomes continue to dwindle because of the crippling Israeli blockade.
The situation in Gaza, especially during the holy month, is very difficult. Poverty and unemployment rates are very high, and people can hardly afford to buy food to prepare their meals and break their fasting.
People usually shop for food items to prepare their iftar meals a few hours before iftar time, which takes place at dusk. Gazans, meanwhile, find it very hard to prepare their fast-breaking iftar meals due to the harsh economic conditions.
Ramadan is a wonderful month, but people are having a hard time because of the Israeli blockade. There is no purchasing power, and most people just walk around the goods while hardly buying anything.
According to UN reports, the majority of people living in the Gaza Strip are receiving some sort of aid to survive. Unemployment and poverty rates have skyrocketed, and poor people have been getting poorer year after year.
Israel work against the international law. The siege is continued at the time we are in the beginning of Ramadan. Blockade means poverty. Blockade means high average of unemployment.
Experts say the Israeli regime has been fueling misery and suffering in the tiny coastal sliver.
Thousands of Gazan families can't afford to buy food to prepare their Ramadan meals amid the dire economic situation. They mainly blame the suffering on the Israeli blockade. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Let's now take a look at the conflict in Ukraine, where airstrikes have rocked the strategic port city of Odessa. Ukrainian air defense batteries are said to have intercepted some of the missiles that were fired at the city. Blasts sent up columns of black smoke with flames visible, apparently, in an industrial area. Russian forces appear to be withdrawing from Ukraine's north, but Kyiv's warning that Moscow is consolidating and preparing powerful strikes in the south. And that echoes a chorus of Western assessments that Russian troops are regrouping. Odessa, a historical city of around 1 million people, is Ukraine's largest Black Sea port. Meanwhile, on the diplomatic front, Ukraine's top negotiator says that Moscow has agreed to key Ukrainian proposals, raising hopes that the talks are moving forward. David Arakimia says that the Russian side has agreed verbally. He did not give details on the terms of the proposals, though. He said, however, that Moscow agreed in talks that a referendum on the neutral status of Ukraine will be the only way out of the situation. No immediate comments from Russia. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said that talks with a hostile Ukraine aren't easy, but he favored the continuation of the process. The two sides have held several rounds of negotiations, and the next round is yet to be announced. The Ukrainian negotiator has indicated any future meeting between the Russian and Ukrainian presidents will take place in Turkey. Okay, that's for Ukraine for now. In other news, China reporting well over 13,000 COVID cases, the highest since the peak of the first wave more than 2 years ago. The highly transmissible Omicron variant has spread to more than a dozen provinces, but has not caused any death. In Shanghai, the epicenter of China's most severe outbreak, nearly all the 25 million residents were under stay-at-home orders on Saturday as officials rushed to curb the spread. But Shanghai's restrictions threatened to snarl supply chains. Some depots in the city remain closed, and trucking services would likely be hit further. The lockdown is likely to drag until late next week, or maybe longer. South Korea may face a serious threat owing to remarks made by its defense minister. The warning came from the sister of North Korean leader. Kim Yo-jong says that the South's statement worsened the bilateral ties and escalated the tensions on the peninsula. On Friday, the South Korean defense minister boasted about his country's military power. He said its missiles are able to hit any target in North Korea in a preemptive strike in case of clear signs of a launch toward the south. Tensions in the Korean Peninsula have been rising since last month, when the North ended a self-imposed moratorium on testing intercontinental ballistic missiles, which had been in place since 2017. An Algerian man who was held at Guantanamo Bay prison for nearly two decades is now back in his country. The Pentagon says it was no longer necessary to keep the man at the U.S. base. Sofian Barhoumi was detained in 2002. American officials accused him of conspiring with Al-Qaeda terrorist group. According to the Pentagon, 37 more detainees still remain at Guantanamo. The notorious prison has drawn international condemnation for torture and abuse of inmates held without charge or trial. The number of prisoners at the facility peaked at nearly 800 under former President George W. Bush. Several U.S. administrations have refused to close the controversial jail that was set up in the wake of the 9/11 attacks. Let's now take a look at Europe and France election polls indicating that immigrant residing suburbs have joined in the nationwide turn to the right. Working-class areas in general appear ready to join with rural voters and rejecting the city-dominated mainstream parties. From Paris, Rami Mazahari reports.
In France, the suburbs around cities are known for being poor, immigrant, often Muslim, and for voting for the left. But a new poll shows that the far right has surged in popularity. At 42% of voter intentions, the far right has become as popular as the three centrist parties combined. It's now only the poorest areas of the suburbs where the stereotype of the so-called red suburb still holds. Overall, 60% of the suburbs are planning to vote for the two political extremes, in a major rejection of the two mainstream parties and President Emmanuel Macron's new party.
These areas feel abandoned by the city centers and the political elite there. So their turn to the political extremes is actually a protest vote. They have a desire to try a different type of politics because they feel that in recent decades, things have only gotten worse for themselves and for France. After decades of alternating power, the mainstream parties are not coming back.
In 2017, the National Front's Marine Le Pen lost in a 66-34% landslide. However, the latest polls show a 53-47% race, which is now within the margin for error. Many Muslims say they are ready to do what was once unthinkable, vote for the far right. Analysts say that suburbs are now voting similar to rural areas and for similar reasons.
10 years ago, people may have voted based on identity issues, but this election is all about class. What we hear voters talking about is inflation, the loss of public services, and unemployment. Mainstream parties don't have a good record on these issues, which have been ignored in this campaign, making these voters even angrier.
The national turn to the right is based on pocketbook issues, but people may also have been persuaded by what's been on the nightly news all year long. France has embraced four essentially far-right politicians among their five leading presidential candidates, and the previous months have been dominated by open xenophobia and contempt for aiding the lower classes. In many ways, the Muslim vote may decide the election. If they join in the expected record abstention, that will ruin the surging chances of the left's Jean-Luc Mélenchon and ensure that a very right-wing president is elected on April 24th. Rami Mazahari, Paris.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
tell a little about yourself?
I'm Eric Shumanandi from India.
I was born actually in London, England.
I'm a journalist by profession.
I'm 20 years old and I'm a student of physics. My dad, who taught me the art of writing.
Listeners Special.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Salam, dear listeners, and warm greetings to you all on this beautiful Sunday of spring. Welcome to this week's edition of Listeners Special. Today is April 3rd, 2022. I'm Atefa Erfani, hosting this program today. Listeners Special is the Sunday program where your views are presented through emails, letters, and messages. So contact us and tell us what you think about IRIB English radio programs. If you have any message for our listeners around the world, then you can record your voice, send it to us, and get your voice heard. Please do remember, Listeners Special is your program. It's your views that are important. And happy the beginning of the blessed month of Ramadan to all Muslims around the world. May God accept our fasting and worship in this blessed month. Keep us company until the end of the program. Welcome back. This is Listeners Special, and we are on a very beautiful Sunday of spring. And here, we truly appreciate those of our great listeners who have kindly sent us reception reports, including Mizanur Rahman from Bangladesh, Juan Antonio Bertolin from Spain, and Paul Walker from the U.S. And we are very happy that we've received these reception reports from our great listeners around the world. It shows their commitment and support to IRIB English Radio. And as usual, many of you have taken the trouble of sending us reception reports. As you may know, these reception reports are very helpful to IRIB English Radio staff, especially to our technicians and engineers, because actually these reception reports enable us to provide a better service to our listeners around the world. And as usual, all of you who have sent in a reception report will be receiving an electronic QSL card from IRIB English Radio. And of course, we've received many emails and letters from around the world, which I mentioned some of their names here. And later during the program, I will read these emails. From Finland, we've received an email from Ismo Kopi. From the UK, we have an email from Richard Cook, one of our regular listeners. Mizanur Rahman, one of our old and regular listeners from Bangladesh, has sent us an email. Again, from Finland, we've received an email from Jerki Hitonen. And the last but not the least is an email from Uruguay, from Freddy Irigoyen. Many thanks for being with us. So we've received an email from Finland, from Ismo Kopi. So let's see what Ismo Kopi says. Greetings from Finland. I'm happy to report that I hear IRIB English Radio loud and clear here in Loja, southern Finland. Please listen to the recording I made and attached to verify I heard you. Part of this hobby is also reporting the reception to the station's head and collect the station's verification. My name is Ismo Kapi and I am 57 years old, entrepreneur from Finland. I am married and I have three lovely children, 26, 17 and 15 years old. I live in a house about 60 kilometers west of Helsinki, the capital of Finland. My hobby is DXing. It is the hobby of receiving and identifying distant radio or television signals. The name of the hobby comes from telegraphic shorthand for distance or distant. Salam and warm greetings from Iran, from IRIB English Radio. To you, Ismo Kapi from Finland. We are so happy that the signals of IRIB English Radio are received in your region. As you said, you live in Loja, southern Finland, west from Helsinki, the capital of Finland. That's great. Thank you for sending us this email. It was very kind of you. So you've become a new listener to IRIB English Radio, and we received the part of the recording you recorded from IRIB English Radio broadcasting, and we verify it here. You are an entrepreneur and you are 57 years old. That's great. And you have three children. God bless you. And your hobby is DXing. Promise to be a regular listener, Ismo Kapi from Finland. And don't forget to tell us your views about IRIB English Radio broadcast in your upcoming emails or letters to your radio station, IRIB English Radio. Ismo Kapi from Finland, my colleagues will soon send you an EQSL card. And from the UK, we've received an email from Richard Cook, one of our old and regular listeners. So Richard says, "Dear friends at IRIB, COVID-19 is slowly declining and I'm waiting for my second jab to begin. I would like to listen to more English broadcasts, but what I can say about your programs is that they are often good broadcasts. I hope you have a good week." First of all, salam and warm greetings to you, Richard Cook from the UK, and many thanks for sending us this message. So, as you said, COVID-19 is slowly declining and you're waiting for your second jab to begin, and that's great. We hope that COVID-19 comes to an end very soon around the world. And in Iran, the situation is good, and the majority of people have received the booster dose of COVID-19. And the COVID-19 is slowly declining in Iran. And as I said, we hope that this virus comes to an end very soon around the world and everyone becomes healthy and safe again. We are so happy that you described our programs and our broadcasts good. That's great. Richard Cook from the UK, write to us soon. We are looking forward to hearing from you very soon. Don't forget to tell us your views about the quality of our programs and signals in your upcoming letters and emails. My colleagues will soon send you an EQSL card as a confirmation. So after a short break, I will be back with an email from Mizanur Rahman, one of our old and regular listeners from Bangladesh. Stay with us, please. Welcome back. Here we've received a congratulatory message from Mizanur Rahman from Bangladesh, and this congratulatory message is on the occasion of Nowruz and the beginning of New Year in Iran and some other countries in the region. So let's see what Mizanur Rahman says. "Dear IRIB English Radio, for millions of people across the globe, Nowruz is no small celebration. The United Nations says Nowruz promotes the values of peace, peace and solidarity between generations and within families. It's a time of reconciliation and neighborliness, contributing to cultural diversity and friendship among people and different communities. And we could all use some of that, no matter what it's called. Nowruz is the Persian New Year, but you don't have to be Persian to celebrate it. Nowruz is a universal celebration of new beginnings, wishing prosperity and welcoming the future while shedding away the past. That's why families use this time to deep clean their homes and closets and buy fresh clothing. Happy Nowruz to those celebrating it. Salam and warm greetings to you, Mizanur Rahman from Bangladesh. Please accept our appreciations to you for this great email and for this congratulatory message on the occasion of Nowruz. That was a great email. Thank you for that. And thank you for your message and your congratulations. Nowruz is a Persian New Year, but you don't have to be Persian to celebrate it. Nowruz is a universal celebration of new beginnings, wishing prosperity and welcoming the future while shedding away the past. Thank you very much. It was great. Mizanur Rahman from Bangladesh, write to us soon and tell us your views about of course, IRIB English radio programs and broadcasts. My colleagues will soon send you an EQSL card as a confirmation to your email. And from Finland again, we've received an email from Jerki Hitonen, one of our old and regular listeners. Jerki Hitonen says, "Dear staff of IRIB English Radio, happy Nowruz to you. Thank you for your email. I recorded a short message. It is attached as to my email. I hope you and your loved ones are safe and well." Salam and warm greetings to you, Jerki Hitonen from Finland. Thank you for your congratulatory message on the occasion of Nowruz. So my colleagues will soon send you an EQSL card as a confirmation. Write to us soon and tell us your views about IRIB English radio programs. And after a short break, I will be back with an email from Uruguay. Stay with us, please. So, here we have an email from Freddy Irigoyen from Uruguay. Freddy says, "Hi, dear staff of IRIB English Radio. Hope you're well. I tell you that for quite some time I have been busy and like to try to listen to distant shortwave radios and to be able to obtain their QSL confirmations to collect, the more distant the better. My native language is Spanish, so it is sometimes difficult for me to listen to other languages. I am not fluent in English, but I understand to some extent to be able to report moments of listening. I could listen to them for now with my portable radio. At the moment, I do not have many recommendations to make due to what was said about the language barrier and that it was only a few minutes of listening. However, I found your programs interesting to listen to." Salam and warm greetings to you, Freddy Irigoyen from Uruguay, and please accept our gratitude to you for sending us this email. So your native language is Spanish, but sometimes you listen to English programs, including IRIB English radio programs. But the letter this email that you've sent us, the context of the language is great. So your English is good. And we hope that you could listen to more programs of IRIB English Radio in the future and tell us your views about our programs. Many thanks for sending us this email, Freddy Irigoyen from Uruguay. Write to us soon. My colleagues will soon send you an EQSL card as a confirmation. And before we wrap up this week's edition of Listeners Special, again, I congratulate all Muslims around the world on the occasion of the beginning of the blessed month of Ramadan, the month of God. May God accept our fasting and worship. So, dear listeners, please keep in touch with IRIB English Radio and your program, Listeners Special, and have a good time.
Dear listeners, your opinion is always important to us. We invite you to spend just a few minutes writing us a letter or sending us an email. We'll be glad to hear from all of our listeners who have any questions or comments about any of our programs. Our postal address is IRIB English Service, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. You can also send your emails to EnglishRadio@irib.ir. That is one word, EnglishRadio@irib.ir. Please visit our website at www.pasttoday.com/en. Our phone number is 00982122013720. Once again, our phone number is 00982122013720. Our profile is also in Facebook. Our address is www.facebook.com/pasttodayenglish. Thank you all for being with IRIB English Radio.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Truce agreements by Saudi Arabia and Yemen's Ansar Allah movement will finally see the lifting of the deadly siege on Yemen and an end to Saudi war after 7 years. According to the UN, the truce will last for 2 months. The hope is that this short-term ceasefire turns into a permanent one. It also comes on the backdrop of increasing Yemeni retaliatory attacks against Saudi targets and facilities deep inside the kingdom in a bid to break the Saudi siege. How much of a role did this play? On this edition of The Spotlight, we're going to discuss that and more with our guests. Ken Stone from the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War joining us from Hamilton. Kevin Barrett, author and Middle East expert, joining us from Madison.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome. Ken, if I could start with you, do you think this truce will stand, or will the Saudis violate it in a similar fashion that they violated the last truce announced in Sweden for the vital Yemeni port city of Hodeidah?
Well, we all hope that the truce will stand and that it will turn into a permanent ceasefire and lead to an end of hostilities and the whole war, the whole Saudi-U.S. war on Yemen. The last truce that was announced in Sweden did not stand, and that was because, and the Saudis violated it at will, and they knew they could get away with it because they had the backing of, the solid backing, the unconditional backing of the U.S. and the U.K., and they went ahead and they blocked the humanitarian supplies, which meant that the children of Yemen did not get the necessary food and medicines that they needed, and they continued to die at the rate of one every 10 minutes, according to UNICEF. But things have changed now. The Saudis no longer have the same relationship with the U.S. and the U.K. Things have changed in the Middle East since last August when the U.S. withdrew in a chaotic fashion, in a debacle in Afghanistan. And things have changed again with the conflict in Ukraine and the calls that were made, the panicked calls that were made by President Biden to Saudi Arabia and to the UAE, which were not answered by the phone was not picked up in Saudi Arabia or the UAE to answer the call to increase oil production to make up for what the West, including Canada, have done in sanctioning Russian oil and natural gas and trying to isolate Russia from the world economic system. So there's been a change in the power relations, and I think that the Saudis may this time honor the truce that they've signed, and hopefully it will lead to a permanent ceasefire, because it's now, last weekend was the seventh year of this war, and we had demonstrations across the country in Canada, and we had an online rally a couple of nights ago, and we know that there is a huge dissatisfaction in Canada with the war in Yemen, because Canada is selling arms to Saudi Arabia.
Indeed, interesting. Kevin, what does it show? What does this show about the facts on the ground? After 7 years, as Ken pointed out, of Saudi Arabia waging war on Yemen and imposing a deadly all-out blockade on its neighbor.
Yes, well, I agree with what we just heard from Ken. A lot of things have changed, and along with the change in the geostrategic situation, as you're suggesting, things, the facts on the ground are changing as well. The Yemenis have shown the ability to hit targets in Saudi Arabia and the UAE, and I think that has leveled the playing field a little bit. Up until now, the Saudis and the Emiratis have been able to operate with complete impunity. They've been bombing Yemen to smithereens, mostly killing civilians, something approaching toward 400,000 civilians have died now from this ongoing war after 7 years, and they've gotten away with it. They haven't suffered much themselves, aside from the humiliation of being one of the world's most heavily armed forces that is getting defeated by a vastly smaller and less funded and less armed force. But in terms of tangible problems, tangible defeats and economic pain and things like that, the Saudis and Emiratis haven't paid a price. And as Ken said, the imperialists have actually been cheering them on and encouraging them. So now the two things that have changed are, one, the geostrategic situation, where the Saudis and Emiratis seem to be no longer on the short leash of the empire. They're not taking the calls of the President of the United States. That's a first. And on the ground, the Yemenis are firing these missiles that are getting through their targets and hitting Saudi oil installations, and not only damaging the oil industry, but more importantly, harming Saudi's reputation and slowing down the tourism, and basically giving Saudi Arabia at least a symbolic black eye. It's nothing like the suffering that's happened.
Kevin,
in Yemen.
Hold on to that thought for just a moment, and let me get back to Ken. Ken, do you see a turn of the tide against the Saudis with Yemen's retaliatory attacks targeting Riyadh's energy, military, and economy?
I couldn't agree more with the question, the sentiment of the question, and the comments by the other guest, my colleague Kevin Barrett. I was so impressed over the last 7 years by the courage and dedication, selflessness of the Yemeni fighters. At the beginning of this conflict, I remember seeing pictures of Yemeni soldiers in bare feet going out to take on the light armored vehicles made in Canada and sold by the Canadian government to the Saudi forces, and defeating them, capturing large numbers of Saudi coalition troops. But over the years, the Houthi forces have managed to arm themselves even better and make these retaliatory attacks with sophisticated missiles and drones, and down the drones of the Saudis and the Emiratis. So they have come a long way in 7 years, and they have demonstrated that they are gaining the upper hand militarily.
Right, so here's the point. Pardon me, Ken. If I could just switch back to Kevin. Kevin, you know, after more than 7 years of indiscriminate airstrikes by the Saudis with the most advanced weapons, let's not forget the Saudis did put their faith in hundreds of billions of dollars worth of weapons from, as Ken says, Canada, but in particular the United States, whereas the Yemenis built indigenous weapons and essentially put their faith in God.
That's right. And it's fitting that this truce would happen at the beginning of Ramadan, which it just started today here in the United States. And it is indeed a Ramadan truce. And there is a history and a whole culture of peacemaking around Ramadan in Islamic culture. And it's true that the Yemenis have demonstrated that kind of faith in defending a just cause that has religious justification, not only in Islam, but in other great religious traditions, and indeed in international law and in philosophical just war ethics. I mean, they're defending themselves against a vastly more powerful aggressor, and they've shown a great dedication, determination, and courage in doing that. So I agree completely with what Ken said about that. And I would add that this is a wake-up call to the other Islamic countries, who are now seeing a new world in which the empire that has dominated them and divided and conquered them for so long and robbed their resources is now reeling and maybe about to fall. And what, you know, where do we go from here? Well, let's get back to our authentic Islamic tradition and ethics, and let's try to make peace between our fellow Muslim brothers and sisters.
Right. Ken, I mean, did the Saudis lose the hearts and the minds of the global public opinion when more and more footage emerged of where these Saudi airstrikes were hitting and who these Saudi airstrikes were hitting and killing?
Absolutely. The Saudis did lose the war for public opinion, our world public opinion. They lost it wherever it was able to be shown. However, we have to keep in mind that at least in the West, the news, the atrocities, the pictures of the destruction, the facts and figures about the Saudi atrocities and war crimes committed in Yemen were hidden from the people. The mainstream media hardly gave them an inch of coverage in the press, hardly ever on TV. It was always about other issues around the world where the United States and Canada had bigger fish to fry. So I would say that, yes, the Saudis continued to lose global public opinion, especially over other issues like the execution recently of 81 people, head chopping, public head chopping, the assassination of the U.S. Journalist Khashoggi, and other other issues such as those. But overall, I think that the Saudi war, the Saudi-U.S. war on Yemen, was mainly hidden from the public in the West.
Well, on that point, let me segue to Kevin. Kevin, the question here is, there have been many accusations of hypocrisy and double standards from the Western governments and Western media alike towards, for example, Ukraine in comparison with Yemen. The conflict in the unfortunate conflict in Ukraine has not lasted 40 days yet. The war on Yemen, more than 7 years, and with too many UN reports highlighting Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. How many Yemeni children are suffering as we speak right now from malnutrition? How many Yemeni children, as we speak right now, are starving to death? Where is the coverage in the Western media? Where is the sanctions against those who are bombing Yemen and imposing the blockade?
Yes, that's right. There has it's true that, in a sense, the Saudis lost the global battle for public opinion, but they really didn't lose very much because, as we heard, they didn't. It's never really been covered. The overall amount of coverage of the Ukraine war, for example, it's got to be by many, many orders of magnitude beyond what we've seen in terms of the coverage of the Yemen war. So 7 years worth of coverage of the war in Yemen is probably a small fraction of what we've seen just in this month and a half of war in Ukraine. And it certainly looks like racism in the way that the Western media plays up the suffering of people in Ukraine and largely ignores the vastly greater suffering in Yemen. I think it's partly racism. It's also probably partly the imperial geostrategy that the empire wants the people to be angry with Russia. So every last drop of suffering in Ukraine will be milked and exploited as much as possible, while the empire has sided with the perpetrators in this war on Yemen. So there's tremendous hypocrisy, but that's all part of the game plan because it's an empire. These are not democratic humanitarian countries. These countries are ruled by a ruthless oligarchical empire that's bent on expansion, and this is really the empire's war on Yemen, probably as much as it is the Saudis and Emiratis' war on Yemen. And so their propaganda apparatus has waged that war really by staying out of it. They couldn't really win it, so they just didn't cover it. Whereas in the Ukraine, the propaganda apparatus is working full-time, overtime, doing the work of many brigades. So we just have to remember that the Western media is not free. It's just part of an imperial propaganda ministry.
Okay, so I mean, so is it the case then with the West that if it's your ally waging war, then it's a good war, and if it's not your ally, then it's a bad war?
That is indeed the case. There is a huge double standard in the West when it comes to wars of the empire versus wars against the empire. The war in Yemen, as your other guest said very clearly, is a war of the U.S. empire. What the U.S. and its allies want to do in Yemen is the same as the British tried to do for the last 100 years previously, and that is to secure the Straits of Bab el-Mandeb on which Yemen sits and makes sure they have control of the navigation through the Suez Canal. It's a strategic choke point in the world, and the U.S. wanted to maintain that choke point. And the U.S. was also, and so was Saudi Arabia, concerned with a rival that they saw in China with its Belt and Road Initiative, which is going to come right across the Arabian Peninsula and link China with Africa and Europe in an economic sphere of influence, which would be beneficial for all, and which the Ansarallah movement has already said it wanted to join. But, of course, the U.S. doesn't want that, didn't want that to happen, doesn't want it to happen, and neither does Saudi Arabia, which prefers instead to try and create a trade route north and south through the Arabian Peninsula, down into Africa and up to Turkey. So this was a huge geopolitical struggle that the U.S. is not winning and probably will not win. And they did not cover it in the same way as the war that took place in Ukraine, which they were turning into a de facto NATO state under Mr. Zelensky and waging a war against the Russian-speaking people in the east of the Ukraine called the Donbass. And when the Russian government reacted, as it would, had no choice, as it was pushed in the corner over 30 years of expansion of NATO, the mainstream media in the West went wild against Russia, demonizing everything Russian. You can't play hockey in this country unless you, if you're a Russian player, unless you swear allegiance, unless you condemn Russia. You can't play Tchaikovsky. You can't dance in a ballet, that's written by a Russian. It's something we haven't seen since 9/11, the intensity of it. So there is a huge double standard in the West when it comes to wars. It was exemplified to me in a cartoon which I put on our Facebook page, on which Western leaders are standing on a mountain of dead corpses, bloody corpses of victims of their wars in Yemen, Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Libya, and they're pointing their fingers toward Russia in this cartoon and saying, Putin bad, bad, bad. It's a huge hypocrisy.
Right. Kevin, I want to ask you about NATO's complicity here in Saudi war crimes committed in Yemen. How complicit is it? How complicit is the West, in particular the United States? We all saw the remnants of the bomb marked Made in America that killed some 40 Yemeni school children in a school bus. And this is American intelligence, at the end of the day, on which targets to hit in Yemen.
Yes, NATO and the U.S., which is, of course, the master of NATO. NATO is really a euphemism for the U.S. occupation of Europe and now for the extension, or the attempted extension of the U.S. empire around the world. And so the U.S. and NATO have been arming, funding, training, guiding, advising the Saudi forces as they bomb Yemen. So, yeah, absolutely. NATO and the U.S. are 100% complicit. And this really illustrates how public opinion in the U.S. doesn't matter. As we've heard, the Saudis did not win U.S. Western public opinion on this war ever. And Biden had to promise to stop this support for the Saudis while he was running for president. But once he became president, he just obeyed the real masters, who are the folks in the National Security Council and the other strategists, the permanent deep state who control the shadow government and direct the policy of the empire, regardless of which politician is in office. And those people are the ones who probably helped orchestrate this war in the first place. And the U.S. has been not just selling military equipment and making a tidy profit at it, but also overseeing its use and training people on it and guiding the targets and so on, the same sorts of things that they're doing with in Ukraine, and they've done with the Ukrainian military, which provoked the Russians into doing what they did. So this empire, again, it's not democratically run. It's not really run by the politicians. They're just figureheads and frontmen, and it is completely complicit in these atrocities.
Ken, war crimes were not just committed by Saudi Arabia, as